Welcome to Already Perfect, the Seattle Soto Zen podcast.
So, as most of you are aware, last year, 2021, at Seattle Soto Zen, I decided it was going to be the year of Dogen. And so, pretty much all the Dharma talks that year were based on Dogen Zenji's writings. And it went really well. I was actually surprised how well it went. I even did a series of lectures on an essay from Shobo Genzo called Being Time, which is one of the most challenging essays that Dogen wrote in his unfortunately short but prolific teaching career. And I don't know. I think that made me a little bit overconfident because I mostly got away with lecturing on Being Time. So I sort of started to think I was a good Zen teacher. And then I was like, well, a follow up on that success, what are we going to do for 2022? And my Dharma sister and teacher, Chris Burkhart, at Red Cedar in Bellingham, she said, well, I would like to do the fall practice period with Seattle Soto Zen to lead it. And I want to focus on Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. I was like, okay, well, how can we sort of make the rest of the year's teaching sort of lead up to Shantideva? And I said, well, let's say 2022 is the year of compassion. Have a year of Dogen, we'll follow it with a year of compassion. So compassion teachings all year. And people seem to like that. They're like, well, you know, after 2 years of the pandemic and the whole political landscape in the US, we do need a year of compassion. That's a great idea, Kanchan. With the support and guidance of the Practice Council, that's what I did. Now that we're at the end of March, I realized that this actually isn't as easy as I thought it was going to be. I noticed I've been like sort of procrastinating on writing my Dharma talks. I realized I'm actually a lot more comfortable and confident talking about Dogen's bizarre philosophical ramblings than I am talking about, you know, squishy feelings. I really don't actually know what to say about compassion. So today I'm kind of doing an experiment because I literally could not write anything in preparation for this Dharma talk. But I did find an article by Gil Fronstall. So I'm going to read it to you and sort of interject my own comments in between. I don't know if this is really a Dharma talk or if this is like I'm treating you like my therapist, but hopefully I won't embarrass myself too much or bore you too much. So this is a 2011 Dharma talk by Gil Fronstall. That's, you know, it's been rattling around in my head since I read it, but again, trying to write down my thoughts on it. It just didn't work. And really, the part that really struck me was the first paragraph. So Gill starts off by saying, compassion is inextricably linked to the Buddhist practice of liberation. It can be the motivation for this practice as well as the result. As one's inner freedom grows, one's capacity for compassion increases. As one's compassion increases, so does the importance of freedom. Liberation supports compassion, and compassion supports liberation. They both benefit when they go hand in hand. Of course, liberation in Buddhism is ultimately nirvana. And, you know, I kind of, I knew liberation was sort of the goal of the practice, and I knew that compassion was an important part of the practice. But for some reason, seeing compassion as intrinsic to liberation is more challenging for me. I don't know why. I guess it's my discomfort with squishy feelings, because liberation is sort of, you know, getting over your feelings, right? There's a Chan teaching of being like a wooden robot that you're no longer moved by feelings. You're just kind of moved by the essential life force of the universe. So you do everything right. And then you don't have to feel anything anymore. But obviously, Gil Fronstal doesn't take that approach. Goes on to say, compassion is a form of empathy and care that wishes for the alleviation of someone's suffering. Known as karuna in Buddhism, this compassion is sometimes referred to as the jewel in the lotus. The lotus supports the heart or mind that with practice blossoms into freedom, and the jewel represents the compassion appearing in the center of this blossom. The feeling of unfettered compassion is one of the most beautiful feelings a person can experience, providing valuable meaning and purpose to any human life. Its presence is sometimes celebrated in Buddhism as an inner wealth and source of happiness. Again, this is kind of not what immediately comes to mind when I think of compassion, that compassion is a source of happiness because it is so intrinsically linked with this empathy for another suffering, right? And it's like, I have enough suffering of my own. Now you're asking me to take on someone else's. And how can that be a source of happiness? And I think part of it is that I'm happier when I focus less on my own problems. I've had issues with depression for basically my whole life. And for me, the number one sign that I'm in danger of another depressive episode is what's called rumination, which is sort of just running over my problems again and again and again. And thinking of all the mistakes I made and what I should have done differently. And it's a symptom of depression. It's also a cause of depression. So the more I think about everything wrong with me, the worse I feel. And sort of this being able to look beyond the end of my own nose is really helpful. And, you know, this does bring meaning and purpose to a human life. Even if I can't solve someone else's problems, just being there, witnessing and caring is, you know, it's doing something. It's doing something more useful than lying in bed and thinking of all the stupid things I did when I was younger. Given its importance, Buddhism doesn't leave the manifestation of compassion to chance. We don't have to passively accept how often and how strongly we happen to experience it. Instead, it's possible to actively develop our feelings of compassion and remove the obstacles for our feeling compassionate. This is important. This is something we've talked about before in Seattle Soto Zen. Is especially last spring, we did a class on the Lojong slogans, Norman Fisher's book on the Lojong slogans, that there's a practice of training the mind to be more compassionate, which is sort of difficult for a lot of people, that, you know, that compassion is a skill that we can develop, that is not, you know, some people are born saintly and the rest of us are slubs who do stupid things and then lie awake in bed years later thinking about all the stupid things we did and all the people we hurt. But yeah, it's actually, you know, something we can develop. We can work on, consciously work on developing our capacity for compassion. And then when we need it, it arises more easily. Because people sometimes confuse compassion with feelings of distress, it is helpful to clearly distinguish these two. Compassion doesn't make us victims of suffering, whereas feeling distress on another's behalf often does. Learning how to see the suffering in the world without taking it on personally is very important. When we take it personally, it is easy to become depressed or burdened. We can avoid taking it as a personal burden or obligation if we learn to feel empathy without it touching our own fears, attachments, and unresolved grief. That's the trick, right? And again, it fits into this whole struggle I have with rumination, is that even when I'm doing my best to be with you in your suffering, I still can't see beyond my own nose, right? I have to turn it into my own suffering. You know, I can't. I can't really be with you because I get tangled up in it too. And that's not, you know, that's something everyone does. I know a few of you are counselors and therapists and chaplains. And yeah, it always happens. We get tangled up in another's feelings. It touches a chord in us, and then we're off in our own unresolved grief, our own fear of abandonment. And yeah, it's hard. This is why there's so much teaching in Zen about not getting so wrapped up in our illusion of self. Not to Kodo Suwaki talks about the self, selfing the self, that we're constantly, you know, that the self isn't some, you know, kernel of essence somewhere within our bodies or minds. It's this process, you know, and we're constantly creating ourselves over and over again, reminding myself of what I'm supposed to be like. So it's the self selfing the self, just this continuous, you know, creation of a personality that, you know, sort of puts energy into perpetuating it. And if we didn't work so hard on convincing ourselves that we are the way we think we should be or the way we think we are, then we might have a little bit more energy and a little bit more space for other people. So Gil goes on to say, this means that to feel greater compassion for others, we need to understand our own suffering. Mindfulness practice is a great help in this. With mindfulness, we can better see our own suffering, its roots within us, and the way to freedom from suffering. We can begin to cultivate both equanimity toward our suffering and release from its causes. Paul Haller and somebody else, they did a workshop on mindfulness. And some of you might have actually done this training. You start with eating a raisin, spend like half an hour eating a raisin. I said, you know, you keep talking about mindfulness and I keep hearing this word and I've never really heard an explanation for what mindfulness is. And Paul tried to explain it. I don't remember what he said, but I said, that kind of sounds like curiosity. And he said, yeah, if you want to think of mindfulness as curiosity, that isn't too far wrong. So that's what I've done ever since. When I see the word mindfulness, my mind has substituted curiosity. So can we have some curiosity towards our own suffering and its causes? Can we have some curiosity, like, what would it be like if I could put down this particular envy or resentment or old guilt and shame, you know, without necessarily doing it, but just like, what would it be like if I tried to do that? I've sometimes challenged people who say, like, I can't stop being so hard on myself because once I do, I'll take out my anger on other people instead. And I'll say, well, maybe try it for a week. And if you find that you're taking out your anger on other people, then you can go back to being hard on yourself. But just for a week, try to talk to yourself a little bit more gently and see if what you're scared of really happens. So can we approach our own suffering and our own fear of connection in that way, where it's like, well, let's do an experiment with not being so scared, not being so ashamed. Try it out for, you know, a day or a week or a month and see what happens. And if, you know, if it makes me a worse person, then I don't have to keep doing it, right? In this regard, it's helpful to appreciate the great value in staying present, open, and mindful of suffering, both our own and that of others. We often need to give ourselves time to process difficult events and experiences and to let difficult emotions move through us. When immediate action is not required, staying mindful of suffering doesn't necessarily require a lot of wisdom or special techniques. It mostly takes patience and perseverance. Relaxed mindfulness of our own suffering increases our ability to feel empathy for others' difficulty and pain. It gives time for understanding and letting go to occur. By practicing to be free of habitual reactivity, we take the time to see and feel more deeply what is happening. This allows empathy to operate and for deeper responses to arise from within. In this way, compassion is evoked rather than intentionally created. There's a story about a student who asked his teacher, you know, how did you get to be so enlightened? And his teacher's response was to pull out this battered old Zafu and show it to him. Like, yeah, it's just sitting zazen, sitting long and getting tired is the koan. You know, that there isn't, you know, was it intelligence or lack of it doesn't matter. It's just patience and perseverance. Being able to sit through whatever happens. And yeah, it's just, sometimes it's just wearing out a lot of zafus. Which I don't know. I don't think the student was particularly happy with that response, but a lot of the time that's just what it is, right? We think, oh, that person must have some special quality that I could never emulate. And it's just this, you know, stubborn persistence, even when things from day to day don't seem to be much different. Just, you know, keep doing it, keep sitting through it, or not sitting through it, or sitting with your emotions and breaking down and crying through zazen. Some people are reluctant to actively cultivate compassion because they worry that it will be insincerely or artificially contrived. Others fear that it will make them sentimentally naive or prevent them from seeing others clearly or realistically. Perhaps out of concern, they'll be taken advantage of if they are compassionate to others. Because efforts to be compassionate can be misguided, these concerns are worth keeping in mind. However, as there are healthy ways to increase our compassion, the concerns don't have to inhibit our efforts to do so. When I was very sick as a child, I had a high fever, but I was really cold. I felt really cold. And I was, you know, wrapped up in these blankets. And my mom tried to help me because I was shivering no matter how many blankets I wore. She got an electric blanket and wrapped it around me. And I was still shivering. And then they took me to the hospital. And at the hospital, they immediately stripped all my clothes off and dunked me in an ice bath. And I was screaming at them, stop it, I'm cold. And they said, no, you're not. I think that's what we fear, right? We fear that we'll give people what they want when it's making them worse. You know, And I think, I mean, I don't think my mom would have been able to dunk me in an ice bath with all the screaming and crying and everything else, right? It took a nurse who had never met me before to put up with my complaints and do what had to be done. So I think it's true. Sometimes it can get in the way, you know, because you know, my suffering was real and what I felt was real. It just wasn't what I thought would help wasn't what helped. It even made it worse. So there's something Chögyam Trungpa talks about, which is idiot compassion. That's like giving more blankets to someone who has a fever. So we do have to watch out for that. However, that's not an excuse to harden our hearts. And I think, you know, we'll be made fools of regardless, right? Remember, there's a webcomic called XKCD, which is these little stick figures who make math jokes. If you don't like math jokes, you probably won't like this webcomic. But remember, one comic was he searched for I should have kissed her, and he searched for I shouldn't have kissed her. And there were five times more results for I should have kissed her than I shouldn't have kissed her. So he said, my conclusion is go for it. That sometimes we're more likely to regret what we don't do than what we do. If that we regret playing it safe and not taking a chance and not reaching out. So if we're afraid of being made fools of, chances are it'll happen anyway, whether we try to protect ourselves or not. One effective way of developing compassion is creating conditions that make it more likely to occur. That is, rather than directly making ourselves more compassionate, we can engage in activities that make it more likely to appear naturally. A condition for compassion is a sense of safety. It's easier to feel compassionate if we feel safe, and very difficult when we don't. Therefore, to develop a confident and compassionate life, it can be helpful to find appropriate ways to feel safe. Locking ourselves in our home may feel secure, but it's not conducive to caring more about others. Learning how to be safe while in the world is more useful. So is using mindfulness practice to address some of the anxieties and self-preoccupations that make us more likely to feel threatened. I talked a couple weeks ago, I gave a Dharma talk on the gift of fearlessness. There's a teaching that there are three types of giving, which are material things, the Dharma teachings, and fearlessness. And I actually read from an essay Gil Fronsdal wrote about the gift of fearlessness. Two of the things he said, one way to give fearlessness is to not give people reason to be afraid of us. To not make people afraid of me. And another way is to try not to be afraid of other people, but within reason. I mean, of course, other people are, people hurt each other in so many ways all the time. So it is appropriate in some situations to be afraid of other people. And, you know, if And there's also a lot of ways that we're inappropriately afraid of people. That we don't give people the chance to disappoint us by assuming they're going to disappoint us before they have a chance to say or do anything. It is important not to feel obligated to be compassionate, as this often leads to self-criticism and stress that interferes with the arising of a natural compassion. Buddhism doesn't require us to feel empathy and care for others. It does say, however, that we have the capacity to be compassionate, and that doing so is a wonderful asset to ourselves, to others, and to the practice of freedom. The focus can be on how compassion enriches us and not how it depletes us. This is an important aspect in compassion and loving kindness training, is that you start with what's easier, right? Maybe I'll never get to the point where I can feel compassion and loving kindness for my ex-husband, right? But I especially won't be able to do it if I start there and start to feel badly about myself and try to force myself to feel compassion that I don't feel, and then feel angry with myself for not feeling the compassion that I should feel, but I don't feel. So start with what's easier. And then if it gets to be too much of a strain, then, you know, fall back. The traditional teaching on loving kindness meditation is to start with the self, because there was an idea when the Buddha taught it that it was easy for people to feel loving kindness for themselves. I guess people back then didn't suffer in quite the same way we suffer here and now. Because for a lot of us, that's not so easy these days. So I say, well, start with the beloved person. Instead of going the self and then the beloved person, start with a beloved person. And then maybe the neutral person. And then try the self. And, you know, if that doesn't work, go back to the beloved person. Some people are hesitant to cultivate compassion because they worry they will have to give up too much of themselves as they help others. Or they fear they will have to spend time with people they feel uncomfortable with. By knowing we are not obligated to be compassionate, it may be easier for us to use our best wisdom and common sense to understand when acting on compassion is appropriate and when it is not. Having confidence in our skill to respond to other suffering can also make it easier to feel compassion. We feel helpless, too uncomfortable, or even threatened by the troubles others are facing. Awareness of their suffering may add to a sense of personal threat. Developing skill has a lot to do with slow and patient training in such things as mindfulness, concentration, and letting go. That was when I was a hospital chaplain in San Francisco at SF General. Before we started doing rounds with patients, our trainer was told us a couple of times, you know, if you show up and ask the patient, you know, would you like to talk to the chaplain? Then they throw you out, you know, just leave. Just leave quietly. Because it can be the best thing that happens to that patient all day. They don't have the power to throw their doctors and nurses out of their hospital room, right? If the nurse shows up and says, I'm going to take some blood, they can't say, get out of here. I don't want to talk to you. Or they can, but it won't do anything. So sometimes just saying, okay, sorry to disturb you, and walking away is, you know, the best thing that'll happen to them all day. And that did happen quite a lot. Yeah. I'd be cold calling on patients. And I'd say, hi, just thought you might like someone to talk to. And I'd be like, no, go away. I'd say, okay, have a good day. And also, it was really hard because, you know, I don't know if you can get enough training to really be able to help someone who's suffering the way a lot of these patients were suffering in the hospital. And it's like, I have no idea what to do. But, you know, after a few weeks, I realized you don't really have to know what to do. You just kind of have to show up. And, you know, I learned certain skills, like how to pray for people and with people and stuff like that. And, you know, sometimes trying and failing is the best we can do. A way of strengthening compassion is to understand and then release what prevents it from arising. For example, tension and stress limit compassion. When we're stressed, we're usually too preoccupied for empathy to operate. However, when we're relaxed, our capacity for empathy increases. People who cultivate deep states of calm often find it naturally opens their hearts to great capacities of compassion and love. That's sort of a lot of people who've been, Shuso, who've been head student for a practice period, kind of your the final hurdle to becoming a teacher. You know, you have to get through being a student for a practice period, and it ends with everybody in the practice period asking the Shuso a question, a Dharma question. And, you know, there's really no way to prepare for it. I know I stayed awake the night before trying to think up all the questions that people would ask me, because there's like, you know, stuff that I talked about in my Dharma talk that I was sure people were going to ask me questions about, and like trying to rehearse. But then, you know, they try to keep the ceremony moving pretty quickly, right? So you're supposed to answer fairly quickly. And when I realized that people weren't asking the questions that I'd rehearsed for and that I had to say something fairly quickly, you know, I just kind of said whatever came to mind. And then, you know, I'd whack my stick and we'd move on to the next person. And as soon as I was able to start doing that, it ended up being fine. I mean, at least for me. I don't know if anyone else was at all helped by anything I said. But people talk to me about it later and they'd say, I just want to say that the answer to my question that you gave was really meaningful. I've been thinking about it for weeks, and I'd be like, oh yeah, what question did you ask and what did I say? It's all just a blur, right? So, yeah, it's kind of if you can, when you're able to let go of that, that tension, that fear of saying the wrong thing or looking stupid, then you just kind of allow this compassionate response to naturally arise. Selfishness and self-preoccupation also obstruct compassion by blocking the attention and sensitivity that is needed for compassion to arise. One benefit of letting go of selfishness is that compassion arises more easily. It's hard, right? Because, you know, I do have a lot of problems. We can increase the amount of compassion we feel in our lives by setting the intention to do so. That's very important in Buddhism, is intention. We can increase the amount of compassion we feel in our lives by setting the intention to do so. This can be quite specific, such as intending to be compassionate in a particular situation or toward a particular person, or it can be more general, as intending to be compassionate for this day or this week. When we consciously set this intention, we're more likely to be reminded of and think in terms of compassion. We will also notice compassionate thoughts and impulses that occur, but which may otherwise be overshadowed by different desires and concerns. I remember I was talking to my sister, this was years ago, and we got into an argument that we get into. And she said the thing that she said that started this old argument. And I responded the way I responded when she said what she said. And, you know, I could kind of see in her expression that she was sick of having this argument again too, but somehow neither of us could stop ourselves. And then I started hearing the Enmeijuku Kanengyo in my head, this chant of compassion. And it was like, I tried to stop thinking about the Enmeijuku Kanengyo so I could keep arguing with my sister. But the more I tried to concentrate on the argument, the louder the Enmeijuku Kanengyo got in my head. And I just changed the subject in like some really obvious way. Like, oh, look at that dog over there. Or something equally inane. And what was amazing is that my sister went along with it. She was like, oh yeah, is that a poodle? And it was just like, yeah, there is, you know, there is an alternative. We can kind of let go of whatever else seems to be important. Whatever is blocking our compassion, we can sort of put that down and allow the compassionate response to at least have a chance, right? Finally, understanding how compassion is a form of love helps us recognize what a jewel it truly is. When it arises from inner freedom, it is then connected to other beautiful capacities of our hearts. It can appear together with well-being, calm, clarity, and peace. There is, in fact, a great deal we can do to make compassion a more central part of our lives. As compassion grows, our self-centeredness and clinging decrease, and liberation becomes easier. As we become freer, compassion becomes more readily available. To let compassion and liberation support each other is one of the most beautiful ways of training in the Buddhist path. It can be our gift to the world. So I think there's a lot of misconceptions about the self and selflessness in Buddhism. I think there were a lot of early teachers maybe misled people when they talked about, you know, killing the ego or getting rid of the ego. And I don't think we actually have to kill anything. But it's sort of, you know, if I can hold on to this idea of self a little bit more loosely, you know, if I stop putting so much energy into convincing myself and others that I am what I think I am, then that sort of opens up a lot of new possibilities in how I relate to myself and how I relate to others and how much energy I have for others and how I can see and hear and make space for others, because it's not as threatening to this idea of myself that I'm propping up and trying to convince everyone over and over again is true. So if I can let go of that a little bit, then I can be freer and more available for people. And if I can be more available for people, then I can sort of help to liberate others with my, you know, the Bodhisattva vows. And if I can bring, you know, safety and freedom to others, then I'm more liberated myself. So this is, I think, how compassion and liberation go hand in hand. That, you know, it's not that we need to destroy our sense of self or stop living my own life and spend all my energy trying to please others. It's, you know, sort of just seeing how much energy I put into convincing everybody that this version of me is real and solid, and, you know, allowing it to be a bit softer and more nebulous. Allowing myself to feel with others and not being so afraid. I want to end with, I found this little book of poetry at my parents' house. It's a book of poems by Gordon Downie, who was a very beloved songwriter in Canada. He was a lead singer of a band called The Tragically Hip. And he died a few years ago of cancer. It was very moving, his final concert, because, yeah, everybody knew that it was his last time performing before he died. And he was very moved, and the audience was very moved. And I watched it live on television because the tickets sold out like within 3 minutes of being put on sale. He was a very sweet man. You probably haven't heard of him if you're not Canadian, but he was a very sweet man. This is a poem called Toboggan Hill. I'm thinking back to when we were young and eating donuts with a set of plastic vampire teeth that we were passing back and forth. We weren't so young as to think a dog was a horse, nor were we old enough yet to name the cold purpose of musical chairs. We were like-minded spirits, eking out a rhythm, whispering transmissions through wet woolen mittens. Growing up on a toboggan hill, nothing was material. I'm thinking back to when we were young, if only to find out forensically what it was we used to want. I'm thinking back to when we were young and eating donuts with a set of plastic vampire teeth that we were passing back and forth. We weren't so young as to think a dog was a horse, nor were we old enough yet to name the cold purpose of musical chairs. We were like-minded spirits, eking out a rhythm, whispering transmissions through wet woolen mittens. Growing up on a toboggan hill, nothing was material. I'm thinking back to when we were young, if only to find out forensically what it was we used to want. Thank you all very much for your kind attention. Thank you for being my therapist this morning as I struggle with the idea of compassion and how to talk about it. And I needed a push to get me to see wherever I am, I'm already free.
Thank you for listening. Please find us at seattlesotozen.org. Our theme music is by Stuart Davis. Gosho!